to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
Boy, I've done the Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast for two siblings who love books.
We love books so fucking much
that I cut one out of a kid and used it to open a doorway to an alternate universe.
That's fucked up, bro.
That's kind of fucked up. I couldn't help myself. I just love the book so much.
You, like, must recreate the experiment. I love the book so much, I became an atheist.
The Golden Compass, the least atheist book ever.
Of all time. Yeah, so this week we're reading The Golden Compass by Philip Pullman.
Oh, by the way, this week we're reading The Golden Compass by Philip Pullman.
He kind of did a spoiler bomb there right at the beginning.
Oh, by the way.
But whatevs.
We have a spoiler policy. And that spoiler policy is we will spoil everything in the book. Like, everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Including the last 5 pages.
Yeah.
Where Lyra's friend gets cut open and her dad opens the new universe.
So there's that. Also, we spoiled that it starts in London by speaking in our authentic British accents.
Our extremely authentic British accents.
Do you think those are more or less authentic than our Appalachian accents?
Well, goddamn. That's true. Probably more, because I think there's not much worse than our attempt at Appalachian accents.
They were pretty bad.
So just really quick, our listener response from last week. We got a note from Catherine Weller, who told us that To Kill a Mockingbird is her favorite book of all time!
Woohoo!
Like Kanye West or something.
Yeah. Well,
he probably doesn't read.
But To Kill a Mockingbird is Kanye West's favorite book of all time?
Of all time.
I didn't know that. Thanks, Catherine. Oh, wait, she didn't tell us that?
No, she didn't tell us that. Okay. She just wanted to drop a note and let us know that she thought the movie was definitely worth watching and that it's an actually kind of an interesting study to see what in the book they take out or change and how you can kind of relate that to what the 1960s viewed as acceptable to put into a big mainstream movie. She also dropped us a note letting us know that there's a Harper Lee biography out there, apparently quite interesting, called The Mockingbird by Charles Shields. Neither one of us had read it, but
Gab's gonna have to now.
I probably will next week. And also, Harper Lee is still alive.
As it turns out, so, you know, like, somebody let her know she needs to listen to our podcast.
Yeah, obviously.
I bet she does that all the time.
Yeah, she probably like it so much.
Yeah. Yeah, she's 86, which is old, but not ridiculously old.
Yeah, I was like, oh, she's still alive. She's gonna be like 100. Well, no. Kind of misjudged yeah, that
only
one.
Only 86.
Yeah. God. Get older or something. Yeah, so anyway, thanks for your comment and thanks for listening. So, moving on to The Golden Compass.
Yeah, The Golden Compass.
So we forgot to mention last week that To Kill a Mockingbird was the start of our banned book series.
Yeah, the last week, actually the last half week of this month and the first half week of the next month is banned book month, or banned book month. That week is banned book month.
Interesting.
If by banned book month you mean banned book week. So
end of September to, like, October.
That is one whiny kitty.
Lol. End of September to beginning of October. And so we have To Kill a Mockingbird last week, which is a frequently banned and challenged book, and The Golden Compass this week, which is also a frequently banned and challenged book.
Yes, for entirely different reasons, but
yeah. And next week, another book on the list, so.
And then the week after that, probably one more book on the list.
Yeah.
Shut up, we cat. Haven't figured out which one yet. So anyway, I definitely have a theory that most of the books worth reading have been on a banned or challenged list at some point in their existence.
Yeah, and actually, if you go back and look at everything we've read, we have a pretty good number of banned and challenged books on there already.
Yeah, virtually everything, minus a couple of the more classic
classics
ones, I guess.
Yeah.
But even out of those, like the more contemporary classics.
Yeah, and I guess we did mention like that the Scarlet Letter had been challenged because it like promotes adultery or whatever.
And the Lord of the Flies has been challenged.
Yeah.
And
Pride and Prejudice.
Pride and Prejudice is probably probably a safe bet.
Wait a minute. But Mr. Collins is so creepy.
If you read between the lines.
Yeah, people should not but be people subjected who
challenge,
to that.
People who challenge books are usually not up to the task of reading between the lines.
Or reading it all, actually.
Or frequently reading the book that they are challenging.
Yeah, which is actually one of the things we wanted to talk about this week. I don't know if anyone remembers that a movie based on this book actually came out several years ago. Apparently, by all accounts of people who have read the book, it's kind of a travesty. But one of the things that happened was there was a huge protest movement against the movie. Like, Christian groups were outside of movie theaters, like, picketing and freaking out about it and saying it shouldn't be allowed to be a movie and all this crap.
It's atheist propaganda.
Yeah. It's gonna make our kids become atheists.
Right. So here's the deal. Philip Pullman is an atheist.
Oh my fucking God.
And he wrote a book.
He's the devil.
He wrote a work of fiction.
All atheists are the devil.
A work of fiction that, for the record, does not actually reference the existence of God in any way, shape, or form. Or at least in the first volume.
Yeah, actually, I think that's true.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, people were apparently freaking out about that whole ordeal, even though this book is not atheist propaganda by any stretch of the word, and is mostly just a good old-fashioned YA fantasy book.
Yeah, and the religious views of the author, I guess, if that is important enough to you that it'll keep you from reading the book, that's your choice to make, but maybe you should actually read a book before you start protesting it. I'll give you an example from the other side. I am also an atheist, as a dozen people switch their podcast off. That's right. I'm the devil. And one of my favorite authors is Orson Scott Card, who is most assuredly not an atheist.
That's true, and is actually kind of has some despicable views,
In my opinion, yes, he does have some pretty despicable politics if you read his blog. You know what? That doesn't keep Ender's Game from being my favorite book of all time. So, in my opinion, deal with it. Like, move on. What's the actual content of the book you're reading?
Well, the thing that actually I think is kind of weird, too, about the huge widespread protests of the movie is movies come out every year that are, like, 100 times more graphic and horrible than the movie of this book. Like, maybe they should be protesting, like, Hostel. You know? Like, I don't know. Maybe horrible torturing of naked people is bad too, guys. Why don't you pick at the Human Centipede?
Yeah.
That's something that no one should ever be subjected to. Just saying. Anyway.
Anywho.
You know Ben and I are against censorship in all forms anyway.
Yeah, pretty much.
So, YA fantasy is right. The genre of the book. And actually, some people, I think, would argue that it's not really that YA.
Yeah, you know, it has the classic YA setup where the main character is just on the verge of pubescence.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly a lot of her ideas are ideas that children have, but a little bit of the, I guess over the trilogy, there's a little bit of the coming of age thing going on.
Yeah, and I mean, it is focused around her learning things and being important in the greater scheme, which we get hints of in the first book.
But at the same time, you also have some fairly graphic violence.
Some adult issues going on.
Definitely.
And an argument someone made was, you know, just because your characters YA aged, does that mean your protagonist, just because they're 11, does that mean the book has to be YA?
Right.
Like,
I mean, I wouldn't worry about my 11-year-old, if I had one, reading the book, but some people might, and I think that would be a legitimate concern.
I think I read this book for the first time when I was about 12 or 13.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom let me read To Kill a Mockingbird when I was 10, so obviously our parents...
Yeah, reading material, we could pretty much read whatever we wanted. There wasn't... I don't think I ever pulled out a book and they said, well, maybe you shouldn't do that just yet.
No.
Kind of, nah, tackle it. We'll see what happens.
Good luck.
I mean, most of the there were books I tried to read that were too adult for me at certain ages, and I either didn't understand them or just never finished them.
I tried to read the Lord of the Rings trilogy in the fifth grade. Oh, man.
Yeah, that probably didn't happen. That's not
very good.
You're going to have to get through Tolkien if you're 10 or younger.
I was like, Council of Elrond.
Unless you're Matilda, she could totally do it.
Well, she's kind of hardcore. Either way.
Yes. So what's our plot synopsis this week?
Scrappy little girl pwns noobs.
There you have it. You don't even need to read it now.
Seriously. Lyra spends the entire book just, like, pwning everyone she meets.
That's true. Frequently by manipulating them rather blatantly.
Yeah.
Though it helps that the people that she most needs to manipulate seem to be insane.
Yeah. But I do like how fearlessly she lies.
Oh, man.
She just does it at the drop of a hat.
That is maybe my favorite thing about her. Because she'll go, oh, yeah, my dad did this. And he was, actually, I guess she still considered him her uncle at that point. But he was captured by the Russians, and he just looked at him, and the guy dropped dead. He's like, that didn't happen. She's like, no, it totally did. And then another guy was walking over to him, and he killed him with a look. And then the last guy, he was like, okay, untie me, and I won't stare you dead. And then he untied him, and then he stared him dead anyway to teach him a lesson. I was like, yes, little girl is awesome.
She's just coming up with all sorts of crap like that all the time. Like, she hears something new and is like, ooh, I can make that into a lie.
Yeah, and she has a thing going on that some of the some of the world's best liars have going on, where she kind of starts to believe her own lies sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
Not every detail every time, but if she tells a story to herself enough times before she goes and tells it to other people, then she totally believes it.
Yeah, I did like that. After she learns that Mrs. Coulter's her mother and Lord Asriel's her father, and Ma Costa was her wet nurse, and she gets the story out of her Ma Costa a couple times, and then she's like, oh yeah, I remember being in the closet. Like,
she's like, you were an infant, no you don't.
Yeah, here, those were the colors of the coats, right? And they had a big sword fight, and she's like...
She just laughs.
Lord Asriel shot the guy. Calm down. You crazy little girl.
And she's very matter-of-fact about her lies as well. Mm-hmm. Or for that matter, about her truth-telling. She's a very matter-of-fact person overall.
Yeah, it's kind of strange that she, like, tells a bunch of fantastic lies, but she's, like, not a fantastical person.
Yeah, exactly. She's described as not being imaginative, despite spinning these stories out all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to real-life circumstances, it's pretty much true.
Yeah.
She just, oh, well, these gobblers kidnapped Roger, so I guess I'm just going to go north and rescue him, and then we'll go farther north and rescue my dad from the giant, invulnerable bears.
No problem. I'll figure it out.
These are things that are going to happen. I'm not going to sit here and worry about why it's going to be hard. We're just going to go do that. All right.
And she does it!
Yeah, well, to her credit.
I think when I was 11, I would not have been able to do
that. I'm like, this is not possible.
And then you also get that other side of her character through Pantalaimon. Who is it? Part of her.
Her demon?
Yeah, so my favorite part of this universe is that everyone has a demon, which is spelled with, like, the A and the E connected to each other.
The Aeneid A-E.
So it's like, yeah, D-A-E-M-O-N-S, but the A and the E are connected. Apparently it's pronounced demon.
Demon?
But it's like, basically what it sounds like is it's a part of your soul or your consciousness or something, but like in animal form. And everyone's take on different shapes, and when you're a kid, your demon can just like change into whatever animal it wants to, like at any time.
Yeah, and it's one part practical and one part kind of according to what you're feeling at the time.
Yeah.
So if you're feeling kind of whimsical, or if you've been trapped below decks on a ship, maybe your demon takes the form of a bird and flies around.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, freedom! And then as an adult, it settles into one form sometime during puberty.
Yeah, that shows your personality, basically.
Yeah, it's actually kind of one of the more interesting parts of the book is to see what kind of characters have what kind of demons.
Uh-huh. And it, of course, sparks the debate of anyone who has ever read the book. What would my demon be?
What would my demon be?
You sit there, like, trying to figure it out. I was like, I really like dogs, but I don't have a dog personality. I
wonder if people bother owning pets and very often in that universe.
Yeah, at first I wondered if, like, animals not attached to people even existed. But then, like, they do mention, like, the dogs pulling the sleds are right. Just dogs and there are birds flying around. So, yes, but, yeah, I feel like there's no point in owning a dog if everyone has a demon.
Yeah, and it can frickin' talk to you.
Yeah, which is way, way awesome, by the way. Yeah, so you have Pantalaimon, who's Lyra's demon, and he, most demons, I guess, are opposite sex from you. Occasionally, they're the same. But he's kind of her counterpart. Like, he's more practical, like, kind of trying to help her come down to earth a little bit more when she needs to.
Yeah, I think the demons kind of do represent, like, a part of your personality that is not dominant, necessarily. Because
mm-hmm.
he's always trying to be the voice of reason, the, this is scary, this is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, she'll be feeling those things, but she'll do it anyway.
Uh-huh.
So, I don't know. Perhaps, I think later in the series, you get a little more illumination on that. But we won't spoil that, because we only spoil one book at a time.
Exactly. So, you want to talk about some of the other characters?
Yeah, sure, why not? So we already mentioned Lord Asriel, her uncle, then turns out,
uncle
actually,
slash dad.
Father, who she's always kind of admired. He seems like a very strong man.
He's kind of a magnificent bastard,
yeah,
almost.
Yeah, kinda.
Except he's not quite of a jackass enough, I guess.
I guess it depends how you want to define it.
Yeah.
He's definitely ambitious, and he's definitely smart and powerful. Powerful in the sense of physically, politically, you name it.
Yeah, powerful in every way.
An intimidating man.
Yeah.
And, yeah, he is just kind of a stone-cold jackass to Lyra for the most part. Except you get, like, I guess towards the end, you really get one glimpse of, you know, he's sent for a child.
Yeah.
So he can open this gateway to the other universe, and she shows up, and he practically has a heart attack right on the spot.
Like, oh, he actually does care about his daughter a little bit.
Like, oh, okay, so he's pretty rattled by that, which kind of implies that he was gonna do it anyway, though.
Yeah,
me.
I know. I did not send for you! Oh, God.
And he's plenty willing to do it to her good friend.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I mean, he's a... You get a lot of mixed morality out of him.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that one of the things that kind of shows his character is when, you know, he built a house with glass in it, like, but he's supposed to be a prisoner, and he has all these books and fires and stuff in there, and his servants just like, yeah, he just, you know, wills things to happen, and they happen. So he just really wanted a kid to show up, so a kid showed up.
Yeah.
I was like, what the hell? This guy's, like, so stubborn, things just, like, appear when he needs them.
He imposes his will on the universe itself.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty good. And, you know, the first person to ever go, yeah, I'm gonna go into a parallel universe, it's totally possible. Whatever.
I can see it, I can go there.
Well, someone who says, I'm going to make death die, or whatever he says.
This maybe just a tad arrogant.
Yeah. This is a little bit.
Hey, mate, bit of the old hubris.
A little bit of the megalomania, maybe.
Yeah, just
maybe a bit.
Maybe a bit. Well, his counterpart, / Lyra's mom.
Mrs. Coulter.
I've been trying to figure out, because Asriel, I'm pretty sure, in some form of the mythos out there somewhere, is actually a fairly major demon or fallen angel or something like that. Mm-hmm. I forgot to look it up because, you know, that's our research policy on this show.
Yeah.
So I was trying to figure out what culture could possibly be and like anagramming, and I couldn't really come up with anything other than cult.
Yeah.
Or
Yeah.
But it's not spelled that way. Or occult, perhaps.
Yeah.
That's the best I could do.
But...
So I don't think it was actually intended to be significant.
Yeah, I think it's just her name.
I think it's just her name.
Shoot.
Damn.
But Mrs. Coulter is the devil.
She is the devil. She collects children for the express purpose of removing their demons from them, which frequently kills them, but no one really seems to care.
Yeah, I mean, since we don't have demons, we actually get a couple of metaphors to kind of try and help you. The idea of cutting someone's demon away, I think he says, is like finding someone with, you know, their insides ripped out or like their head cut off.
Yeah, and there are a couple times in the book when it's illustrated how painful it is to be separated from your demon and how terrified and how emotionally people react to it. And
this idea that we do hear of a couple of examples of people who have had their demons cut away, and they basically kind of become robotic or zombie-like.
Yeah.
Like their personality just disappears and they're basically not there anymore.
The adult characters that's happened to are very dull.
Yeah.
And they find a child who's had his demon removed at one point, and he's ruined.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to describe it.
He's miserable, asking for his demon constantly, and just dies soon after.
Basically dies of a broken heart.
Yeah.
So, yes, it is horrifying to remove this from somebody, and here they are doing it to children as part of these experiments they're doing.
Without caring.
Yep, they don't seem to care.
She's just like, we have to do it so that we can protect them.
Well, she's a little disturbing because she's like this whole charming aspect that she uses on, well, children and adults, really.
Everyone, yeah.
And just on the surface most of the time is just this super pleasant, like really attractive, really admirable seeming woman. And then when you see what she actually has going on, like, her ambition, I think, is a lot like Lord Asriel, actually. Uh-huh. Maybe that's the main thing the two of them have in common. Yeah. Kind of seems like it is at the end.
They're also probably both kind of hot, so they were like,
ugh. Yeah, it's one of those things, yeah. And she just lets this ambition rule her. And so whatever has to happen for her to achieve her ends, she's willing to do.
Yeah, because... I think they mentioned in the book, you know, well, first she tried to get power in the way, you know, women usually get power, by marrying a rich guy. And that didn't really work out for her, but she couldn't become, you know, a magistrate in the church because she's a woman. So she just started manipulating everyone in the church to gain power that way.
Yeah, and so she got herself put in charge of this general oblation board, which I'm not even entirely sure what that means.
Yeah. But if you lure people, if you lure little kids away from their families and then tell them you're going to write, let them write home and then burn their letters and then send them up to certain death, you're pretty much a horrible person.
It's hard to come up with an ethical system where that's okay.
Just saying.
'Tis a fair point. So how about, let's talk about some good people.
Okay.
Like the Egyptians.
The Egyptians, who are gypsies.
Yeah, totally.
By the way.
In case that wasn't obvious.
Like, going around on houseboats and people look down on them and they try to fight really hard to get what rights they do have. Like, oh, that's how gypsies are treated in Europe.
Yeah. This story, the gypsies are kind of the heroes, though.
Yeah, they're pretty badass.
They're like, oh, people are stealing our children and stealing land people's children and... That's not cool. All right, so need some volunteers, and we're going to muster up an army of, like, 200 men, invade the north, and take them back.
Yeah. I liked when Lord Fa, who's the king of the Egyptians, was like, you know, we got to go get our kids back. And someone's like, well, what if we find kids that aren't Egyptian kids? And he's like, what, you just want to leave them there? Like, fucking asshole.
Their kids will rescue them.
He has one line, and I don't think it's in reference to that guy when he says, shame on you, shame, shame. Like, doing the...
That's his style of ruling. He's just a powerful, charismatic guy.
Yeah. And
he doesn't really use direct force on his own people. He just kind of illuminates the situation, and I was going to add to that metaphor, but I don't think I need to. It's like, no, this is what you're talking about, and you're using Weasley talk. This is what's actually happening. Yeah. And then they kind of go, okay, I guess we'll do it your way.
I guess you're right.
He guilts them.
Yeah, a little bit. Well, that's when they want to give Lyra up, and he's like, her dad did all this crap to help us out.
Yep.
So, you're jackass.
Not gonna happen.
So, Dean never swears. That's entirely my addition.
That's true. Lyra is the one most given to swearing, and even then, it's just mentioned that she swears. The actual swearing is not...
Yeah, is not in there. That's why I didn't write the book.
I was actually picturing Lyra as being somewhat scout-like at times.
Yeah.
Like when she goes...
Oh, when Scout's like on her swearing.
Yeah. And her uncle's like, what was that? And Atticus just goes, she's discovered it. Ignore her and she'll get bored of it.
Yeah, like if Lyra and Scout met each other. You crap bag! Yeah. You shithead! Nice. You fucker! She's like training insults back and forth, and they wrestle, try to beat the crap out of each other.
Probably. Jem would be like, I can't be here for this.
I'm leaving now. That's awesome. Someone write that crossover, please.
That's right.
But the other Egyptian we get is Fardar Cordum, which is actually kind of hard to say.
It kind of is. I actually kept reading it as father. Like, I knew it was wrong, but in my head, I'd be like, oh, father. Fardar Cordum.
Fardar Cordum.
Fardar.
He is...
Gassy. Sorry, someone had to say it.
Oh, Fardar.
That was going to have to happen before this was over.
You're such a jackass. He's actually really cool because he's not the physical presence that, like, John Fa or Lord Asriel are, but he's really, really smart.
Yeah, he's speaks in melodious tones.
Yeah, and I liked the mention, you know, because Lyra makes the observation that, you know, he's really frail and shaking and needs, like, a cane to get around or whatever, but then his demon is, like, this just gorgeous cat.
Yeah. And actually, you know, going back onto demons again, because they're just so fascinating.
Yeah.
It seems like the powerful people tend to have these large predatory cats as their demons.
Yeah.
And the leader types tend to have, like, a crow or a raven. And your scientist types tend to lean towards monkeys.
Yeah. All the witches have birds.
Yeah.
Because
they fly.
Can be miles apart from them anyway, so...
Right.
Like, hey, go fly over there and do this thing for me. Uh-huh. But yeah, that is kind of a... Well, Mrs. Coulter's demon is just a devil monkey.
Yeah, it's not your standard monkey. But so the head doctor at the lab had a monkey for his...
Uh-huh.
Though, servants all have dogs...
Yeah, servants all have dogs, which is kind of an obvious parallel.
Yeah.
The soldiers had wolves.
Right, the Russian soldiers did anyway. It's kind of implied that Fardar Cordum, in his youth, was a physically powerful man as well.
Because he was in love with a witch who loved him back.
Yes.
Is kind of the gist of what you get. And
where he was wounded and poisoned and physically kind of ruined.
Yeah. But he's still awesome. And he helps Lyra learn how to read the alethiometer, which I think we should talk about.
Oh, golly, you think?
Is it important?
I think it's, pretty sure that's where they got the title of the book.
What? I don't believe you.
Alethiometer?
Actually, in...
Alethiometer?
In Britain... this book is called The Northern Lights.
Interesting.
And not The Golden Compass. I have no idea why they changed it for the American version, because The Subtle Knife and The Amber Spyglass, I believe, are both the same titles.
Hmm.
Maybe it's just because they wanted, like, an object for each one.
Maybe.
But, yeah. Northern Lights and...
Any marketing people out there?
Original title.
Hmm. When they're far enough north, they can probably actually see them. Sometimes.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, I mean, that's like the whole, they go to the other world through the Northern Lights.
Well, right.
So it's kind of a big deal.
I know.
But so is the Golden Compass.
The alethiometer.
The alethiometer, or the alethiometer.
Alethiometer, or...
Alethiometer sounds more right, like thermometer, alethiometer. I don't know.
I don't know. Basically, it's a little pocket watch-sized thing with 36 symbols on it, and it sounds complicated. I actually think it sounds less complicated than it is, though. And there are three hands that you can adjust on it to ask it a question, and then there's another needle that spins around and touches on certain symbols. And if you know how to interpret all of that, you can learn basically anything.
Yeah, and you can either read it at a really basic level, or you can learn to read it at a really deep level, because as Lyra goes on, she goes from kind of seeing the more basic picture to, like, getting a lot more intricacies.
Yeah.
Like, at one point, she says toward the end, when she asks about Yorick twice, she thinks it's kind of annoyed at her for asking the question right. again. But it's pretty interesting, because the way Farter Cordum is explaining it is all these 36 symbols have, you know, 10, 15, 20 meanings apiece. And so when you adjust the hands to each symbol, you have to hold the correct level of the meaning in your mind. And then you have to know which time the needle is stopping and which meaning that means. So, you know, it'll go around like three times and then twitch on like the wasp or the bee. And then you have to know what's the third level of bee. And so everyone else who's trying to read it has like a giant book. And they'll, like, write down where it's stopping and then go and try and look it all up in the book. And then apparently that takes a long time.
Whereas Lyra can do it much more intuitively, and she gets clearer readings much faster.
Yeah.
Sounds like quite the feat of concentration to me.
Yeah. Although I think it'd be really cool.
Yeah. I do wonder what technology this thing is based on.
Yeah. Magic.
Well, clearly. But they have one of these universes where they seem to have a... somewhat magic-based technology system anyway.
Uh-huh.
Somewhat.
Magic to them is much more commonplace or, like, magical things.
Yeah.
Because if you came up to someone in our world and was like, hey, I have this, like, compass thing that'll tell you the truth, people would be like, you're full of shit! And then in that world, it's like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Oh, of course you do.
I guess if you have, like, animals that are an outward representation of your personality that can change shapes at a moment's notice, like, you're just more willing to believe things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they have... Yeah, the demons are certainly...
And talking bears.
Somewhat
and,
magical.
And witches
to
that
witches,
are real.
Who can actually fly and live for centuries.
Yeah.
And who can perform other forms of magic, for that matter. The universe this is set in, because we kind of skipped over that, is definitely one of those worlds where the actual time, like the actual year, is a little bit up in the air, because it has like that early turn of the 20th century feel to it, but at the same time, it could be a more magic and philosophy-based world instead of a more technology and politics-based world.
Yeah, you're never sure, like, is it supposed to be the present, or at least the present the time the book was written, or is it supposed to be more, like, Victorian-era steampunky kind of thing?
Right.
Or is it supposed to be whatever else? But I did like that point that Ben made when we were talking about it before, is that, well, you know, it could be the present, it's just that their society developed in a different way.
Yeah, if they flipped over a calendar and said, oh, it's the year 2005, I'd believe them. I can buy into that.
People would be like, but you don't have cars and phones, so you're obviously in the past.
We have philosophy and magic. Actually, there's
and some, talking bears,
they,
you win.
They actually refer to their science as, like, applied philosophy and theology.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, their particle physicists are called, like, experimental theologies
or something.
Because she's talking about, like, atoms and stuff, but then she's like, yeah, experimental theologists. And you're like, what? That's not how it works. And actually, speaking of the prevalence of theology in the book, since the religious issue is one a lot of people focus on with these books, and it does become important later on, we should mention the role of the church in religion.
Yeah, so in this world, the Catholic Church is clearly in charge of...
It's not the Catholic Church, it's the Magisterium.
Excuse me, it is the not Catholic Church, and it is clearly in charge of everything. And it was also clearly the Catholic Church.
Yeah. It's like if the Catholic Church hadn't lost a bunch of power during the Renaissance with the rise of Protestantism.
Right.
That's what this church is like.
And they control a lot of aspects of day-to-day life, and they, well, clearly control access to high-level science, at least.
Uh-huh.
Which is actually not what you usually associate the church with. And there is a little bit of a, you know, to me it's almost more of a bureaucracy thing than it is a church thing.
Uh-huh.
Just, I mean, the Catholic Church is, or the not Catholic Church in this universe, is really good at creating bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it wasn't for the Romans, maybe they would have invented it on their own.
Oh.
But there is, like, okay, so Mrs. Coulter runs the General Oblation Board, and they're this subsection of the church that has kind of an important duty, but is kind of, you know, only people in the know really know what it is.
Yeah, because if people heard that you were cutting children's demons away from them, they would freak out.
Yeah, so there's kind of distasteful things, and they let it happen because they think it's necessary. I guess at the end of this book, it turns out that maybe the driving purpose behind that is because the dust, and it's how it's attracted to adults but not to children, and they have this idea that it actually is a physical representation of original sin.
Yeah, Lord Asriel helps bring that up, and I think Mrs. Coulter also mentions, you know, well, demons let the dust in. If you cut them away, then you never get that those bad thoughts and feelings. And so it's this, you know, doing this thing to help, to try and keep people innocent or free from sin, assuming dust is a bad thing.
Right.
And yeah, Lord Asriel brings up a passage in the Bible, which I believe is also in, not only in their fictional Bible, our Bible?
I'm pretty sure it's King James Bible.
From dust you come, and to dust you shall return. Yeah.
You come from the ground, you shall...
Yeah. Yeah. But in their world, they're thinking, maybe the dust is something
is literal.
Else. Yeah. this stuff you can't see that falls from the sky. And yeah, the criticism... Well, I mean, obviously the criticism of the church and the bureaucracy, excuse me, is already there in the fact that they're letting children get horribly tortured.
Yeah.
But at the end, Lyra and Pantaleon kind of have this, well, maybe dust isn't bad.
Yeah,
it's actually a good thing.
So if you're going to tie that into the original sin idea, it is getting a little bit religiously subversive there down the stretch. But
yeah, although nothing too apparent, and we're kind of drawing those parallels ourselves based a little bit on kind of what happens later too.
Right, right.
Although I think it is there, but very muted. And as a kid, you'd never pick up on that.
There is no way I would have picked on... I don't think I would have picked up on that as a 18-year-old reader, honestly.
Because yeah. I remember the first time I read the books, I loved them. And the second time I read them, I was like, there's a lot of religion in here. I didn't even know that. And I'd read them all.
Right.
Like, 13-year-olds, they're not picking up on that crap. They're just like, demons are cool.
I wonder what my demon would be. My demon would be an alligator.
Interesting choice.
No, mine wouldn't be an alligator. Mine would be something fat and cranky like a panda bear.
Nice. I really don't know. Mine would have to be like a really bitchy animal.
What's the most sarcastic animal?
Yeah. I think I decided that my demon could potentially be a fox because they're kind of assholes.
You can go that. Plus, they're known for being kind of crafty.
Yeah. And I'm a little crafty.
And you're kind of foxy.
I'm kind of foxy. Oh, yeah.
Hello.
Ben doesn't actually think that, so... Stop writing your incest fanfiction. Oh, let's see. What else Oh, we should talk about... Do we have enough time to talk about the Bears a little bit?
Yeah, we definitely should.
Okay. Because we already brought up the main plot points for two-thirds of the book, but there is one-third remaining.
OMG Bears.
OMG. The Panzer...
The Panzerborn. That's how I read it.
Does the J, is it silent?
I don't know. You can make it Bjorn, I guess.
Panzer Bjorn.
Panzer Bjorn.
We are obviously not Scandinavian.
Yeah, for that matter, we don't know if Yorick is correct. I know that sometimes, like...
I-O-R-E-K.
Yeah, when you come out of old, like, Middle English, aren't I's J's sometimes?
I don't know.
I think they are. So he's like, well, maybe it's Jorick and Jofer and not Yorick and Jofer, but...
Yorick sounds more right to me.
Yeah.
But, again...
More Shakespearean.
I don't know anything about... Like, if, like, a Swedish person is listening to this, they're probably just like, fuck you.
They probably got there a long time ago.
You're a dick. But Yorick is a Panzerborn. We'll just go with that.
He's a bear.
He's a bear. A talking bear.
Yeah.
With an opposable thumb.
Yes.
Who made... his own armor that's apparently his soul, which is a fucking awesome thing to say, yeah, by the way.
He is...
Mine's made of sky iron.
He is pure warrior.
Yeah.
That's what Yorick is. And that's more of a bear thing, I think.
Yeah, but you have this added aspect of, you know, well, first of all, him liking Lyra because no one can help themselves from liking her.
Everybody loves Lyra.
But he also has that, you know, deposed prince... thing going
yes.
down, but he's too proud to complain about it.
Powerful and proud.
And you definitely have this culture clash going on, and I think the purpose of it is to help show how the church and the events going on are starting to leak into more than just human affairs. Because traditionally, bear affairs and witch affairs have nothing to do with mortal people. They just kind of go do their own thing. And in this book, not the witches as much, although they are definitely, there are witches who help the magisterium and witches who are against it. And the bears are getting pulled into the church's whole plot, too. And so whatever's going on is going to be epic enough to involve all races.
Yeah, and Serafina, the... queen of the witches. Well, not all
the
witches.
One of the clans.
But a witch queen. How's that?
Yeah.
She mentions that there is a war on and everybody is part of it, whether they want to be or not.
Uh-huh.
And
what side are we on? Lyra's.
Yeah, we're on Lyra's side. It's like that's a side?
I know that, but what? I mean,
there are a lot of sides, actually.
But the thing going on with the bears is the current king, Jofer... I-O-F-U-R. So that's our best guess.
Yo, fur!
He does have fur. Ha ha ha. He would, like, just kill me for saying that.
Yeah, right. Swipe.
But he's the current king of the bears, and he's been totally manipulated by Mrs. Coulter and brought into this whole idea of human affairs and has decided to start crafting the bear kingdom to be more like people.
He's losing it a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
He's sitting there on his throne, well, like, in his horrible, stinky palace of rotting animals. Surrounded by flies, but with, like, a little puppet that he's bouncing on his knee.
Yeah. Because
he wants his own little demon.
This is Inslain. Inslain.
Inslain.
Inslain! Insane slash sad is that... he's just been so manipulated into wanting to be a person so bad that he has, this little doll kind of that looks like Mrs. Coulter.
Yeah.
To kind of act as his demon. And on one hand, you're like, this guy's crazy. And on the other hand, it's like, oh, that's, like, pathetic.
Yeah.
And kind of sad.
That he could get to that place to mm-hmm. begin with. And there's kind of a... the bears... I think get a pretty fair amount of characterization in this book. It's mentioned that when bears do bear things, people pretty much can't compete with them.
Yeah.
And then when bears try to do human things, you get this weird, fucked up situation that Jofer is ruling over.
Uh-huh. Because I liked the scene where Yorick was explaining, oh, we'll try to fence me. And so Lyra gets a branch and she's trying to fence him. And every time she makes a feint or a trick, he just, like, just sits there. And every time she actually tries to go for him, he just knocks it away. He's like, you can't trick a bear. Because bears just can't be tricked.
Right.
But then Yofur wants to be a person so badly that he can be. Which is...
Yeah, we can kind of be led around. Yeah. At least.
Lyra totally plays off of.
Yeah, and then Yorick... kills him pretty brutally.
Swipes his bottom jaw off.
Knocks his jaw clean off. Splits him open down the middle and eats his
heart.
Still warm heart in front of everybody.
That's pretty badass.
That's pretty YA.
Yeah. So YA.
Yeah!
Tear down this palace, Mr. Gorbachev. That's right. What he says immediately afterwards. And actually, this thought just occurred to me. I have no idea if this was intended or not, but to kind of tie it back into the church, like, you know, doing things to people, their negative influences causing the bears to be less bear-like.
Yeah.
Or I don't know if it's just to demonstrate that Mrs. Coulter is...
I would tend to lean towards Mrs. Coulter just being a...
Capital B-I-T-C-H. Yeah.
Like a force of decay and entropy.
Yeah.
So we have one more character that I'd like to cover. Lee Scoresby, the Texan, who is...
From the country of Texas.
From the country of Texas, who is 1,000 times more Texan than whatever that loser in...
Dracula
was. Quincy?
Ooh, was it Quincy?
I feel like it was a Q name.
I feel like we should remember it, because we had a pretty good time making up a fake badass history.
Yeah, we really did.
But Lee Scoresby, with his hair demon.
Yes, and his balloons and his...
He's an aeronaut.
Longest pistol anyone's ever seen.
Yeah, I actually love this guy. He's so awesome.
He's the mercenary with the heart of gold.
Yeah.
Which is the male... trope counterpart to the whore with the heart of gold.
he gets to kill people. But he's the kind of silent, strong type, but his silences are always really well used and calculated.
Yeah.
Like, I liked the fact that the narration mentions that Hester, his demon, basically never talks, sits there really calmly most of the time, even looks like she's falling asleep a lot of the time. But is actually, like, picking up on information and sending signals while acting like that. I thought that was really cool. Mm-hmm. Or when he, like, Scoresby gives Lyra a task to go get Yorick, and then he challenges a bunch of Egyptians to poker. Just, like, really calmly. Like.
Right. Like, he's shuffling cards with one hand while talking about how much fun card playing is while doing something else entirely with his other hand.
Yeah. Hester's like, go get him. I heard y'all were good card players.
In Lee Scoresby's story, when he's the main character and instead of Lyra, Hester probably speaks up and has her one brilliant thing to say right at the climax of the story. That's what I'm picturing.
She probably talked more than that.
I just think it's funny if I make the rabbit demon act like Silent Bob.
Apparently. But he is important in that he flies, well, he gets them out of the shit at Bullvanger and then flies Lyra and Yorick and Roger over to Svalbard, where the bears are. And he gets a pretty decent conversation in with the witches about the happenings of the world. And
yeah, that's the conversation where Seraphina mentions that... everyone is at war, whether they realize it or not.
And we get this notion of Lyra as being really important.
Yeah, but we don't... See, that's a little bit of a trope, too. The child of destiny!
Yeah.
The witches seem to have more than a totally vague idea, at least, of why she's important.
Uh-huh.
No one else really does, but what everyone agrees on is that it's important she not realize how important she is.
Yeah, I don't remember... I think it was the consul.
Beginning.
Oh, was it the master who said it?
I think it was.
I thought it was the consulate. Yeah, someone says she has to fulfill her role.
That was the consulate.
But no one can tell her what it is or what she has to do or else she'll fail.
Right. Which is too bad for her, because some of it's going to be kind of painful.
Yeah, it's going to suck.
Like betraying your best friend by accident.
Yeah.
Oopsie.
About that. That's not her fault.
It's not her fault, but she feels responsible.
Yeah. I mean, she technically did take him there.
And it does seem to fulfill the betrayal that was prophesied.
Mm-hmm.
So, there you go.
Well.
All right, so let's hit a couple of themes. We already have a little bit. The bureaucracy being bad. The dust. We kind of, yeah, I guess we touched on the dust and how it relates to, you know, original sin. How big of an element is that?
Mm-hmm.
There's also, we've touched on but haven't really discussed, Lyra beginning this book is totally innocent and insulated in her world. And then, well, she lived her whole life on the grounds of Jordan College, or, you know, maybe occasionally taking a trip to another college. Yeah. And now all of a sudden she's traveling halfway across the world.
Meeting all sorts of different races of people, yeah, and things.
Meeting bears and witches and Texans, oh my.
Oh, those crazy Texans.
And she's figuring stuff out and growing as a character and really discovering, I guess she kind of was a natural leader among children, but like she's really developing that skill she has.
And I think there's this, you know, when you're a kid, you're like, oh yeah, I know how the world works, which is exactly, you know, I know exactly how Jordan College works. Mm-hmm. This is the way the world works. You know, female scholars are dumb and Jordan's the best place in the world and this is how the Egyptians work and blah, blah, blah. And then when she like goes out into the world and starts actually experiencing, learning everything, she starts realizing, you know, how complicated everything is and how she didn't know everything. I think one of her biggest realizations when she learns what's going on at Bullvanger is that she had always trusted adults before because the scholars were mostly harmless and she looked up to Lord Asriel and, you know. And she realizes, oh, adults do shitty things.
Yeah.
And that people who seem good are not good.
Right, because she had nothing but respect and admiration for Mrs. Coulter when she first met her.
Uh-huh.
Now she thinks she's the devil.
Unsurprisingly.
Why would you do such horrible things? I don't understand. Why do bad things happen, almost?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. How's she supposed to know? Nobody knows.
Yeah.
You just know that they do, and that people are capable of evil. And it's a hard lesson to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And she kind of learns it in this book.
But, I mean, does it make her a better and stronger character?
No, I would argue it does.
Yeah, I mean, me too. I'm saying that maybe that's tucked in there.
Right. Well, if you're going to go with the original sin theme, especially, I mentioned in our pre-podcast conversation that to an atheist that ejection from the Garden of Eden is kind of one of those moments of, all right, so you're saying knowledge and awareness is bad? All right, I'm out. I don't need to hear anything else. You're not selling anything I'm buying.
And there are potentially hints of that here.
Yeah.
With the awareness and the growth and the subversive aspects of the church, at least, being against exploration and growth and learning.
Right. Well, and the kind of that, you know, tying that even back into the bureaucracy again, because Lord Asriel and Mrs. Coulter have similar goals, but different approaches to it, and therefore Mrs. Coulter is supported by the church and Asriel is considered a heretic.
Yeah. He's doing the kind of research they don't want him to do, so he's a bad guy now.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's also this kind of love theme tucked in there too, which, you know, happens in a lot of stories, especially in YA stories,
though. Yes.
You know, the love will conquer all idea, or at least in this book, I don't think it's so much that idea, but It's that Lyra's going on this huge adventure and she's having to grow as a person, but she has support from all these people and bears along the way. And down the stretch, the last two or three chapters, she's just so full of love for everybody.
Yeah, she's really learning how to care about people.
Yeah. And I definitely think that is important. We're supposed to take a lot more of that out of the book than that, oh, hey, there's this original sin, knowledge is bad idea in the background. I bring that up because it's interesting, but as far as what is actually emphasized in the text of the book, there's way more of the love and friendship and adventure.
Yeah.
It's part of the reason that a 12-year-old kid can read this book and enjoy it.
And walking away from the book, you go, you know, like, oh, Lyra and Yorick, they're like best friends.
Yeah.
Yay.
Like, I want a giant warrior bear pal.
Yeah. Like, you definitely take that away. And like, his, you know, his nobility and his honor wins him the day.
Yeah, even though it's not exactly a human nobility or honor, but good old Yorick, she knew him well?
No.
No? All right.
Yeah.
Now, get that out of here.
I did want to mention to anyone who hasn't read the book, I think the writing is really strong, and the book's easy to get into and read fast. But the first time I ever read it, and the first time pretty much anyone I've ever talked to has ever read it, chapter one tends to confuse the crap out of people, because a lot of the stuff that's going on, you don't really know the universe yet. A lot of the stuff the adults are talking about that Lyra doesn't understand, you don't understand even more than she does.
Yeah.
And it gets kind of confusing when you finish the first chapter. You're like, what's going on? But if you just read, like, a couple more...
Well, and if you have a shred of curiosity in you, you will read a couple more.
You
definitely get dropped straight into the plot and straight into this world without knowing anything about it.
Because when I was, like, 12, the first time I read this, I finished chapter one and I sat there for a minute, like... What?
Like, hold on.
Like, I didn't even keep reading right away like I do as an adult.
Right.
I was like, I don't understand. So I would give that warning, is that because you're just so dropped into it, it is kind of confusing. But if you stick it out for, like, another 15 minutes and read some more, you'll get into it. And if you don't get into it, then you're kind of a freak.
Yeah, what's wrong with you? The universe building is really amazing in this book. It's really deep. Every element of the world you can go a couple layers into, I think. You can ask questions about it while you're reading it, and you'll find answers, or the ones you don't, you will later in the series. I feel like I didn't have a ton of questions about the universe, at least at the end of the trilogy. Let's see, we talked a fair amount about it being challenged. What questions do we have at the end of this first book?
So what is dust?
Yeah, what the heck is dust?
Is Lord Asriel right? What does it do? Is it good or bad?
What are these Rusakov particles?
Yeah, Rusakov particles. What the heck's going on?
Huh?
Why is everyone so hung up on that shit?
What's so sacred about that human-demon connection? Why does it hurt so much? Like, if they even walk several yards away from each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're both in horrible emotional pain and physical discomfort.
Yeah.
And
what's in that other world that Lord Asriel opens up?
Yeah, there's a golden city. What's up with that?
Is it really made of gold?
Yeah. Is it El Dorado?
Answer, no.
The conquistadors there? Is that where they all went?
That'd be kind of an interesting sequel.
Yeah.
And they get kidnapped by Mayans.
Tie that into the Catholicism.
That'd be pretty weird. So, verdict.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious. We both like this one.
I really love this book, actually.
Gab's calling you a freak if you can't get into it. And I'm raving about the universe building. I love stories with good universe building. Like, I don't even care about the rest of it. This one happens to have good characters and...
A good story.
Good story. And
tightly plotted book.
Yeah, good emotional content.
Yes.
So those are all bonuses, but if you gave me this depth of a universe and everything and it was kind of dull, I would probably still like it, honestly.
So what are we reading right now?
I am more or less reading what I've been reading or finished what I've been reading. My reading for fun this week was The Watchmen, which we're podcasting next week. So I guess that means I get to read twice as much for non-podcast next week.
I just finished today a book called Going Bovine by Libba Bray.
Having a cow.
Well, it's about a teenager who gets mad cow disease, and then he goes on a mission to save the universe. It's kind of the very basic plot of that book. It's pretty fucked up.
All right.
But that's me. That's so, if you want to drop us a comment, you can find us at www.novelideaspodcast.com.
Or hit us up on Twitter at @novelideaspod.
You can email us at novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
And if you are one of our iTunes listeners, leave us ratings, reviews, and whatever else you can do there.
Et cetera, et cetera. And as we mentioned, next week we are doing Watchmen by the esteemed Alan Moore, illustrator Dave Gibbons.
Yes, one of the, well, you know, it's the only graphic novel to make Time Magazine's list of the 100 best That's novels true. Of all time.
And next week, we probably won't talk a bunch about the illustration, but we will discuss it because it is going to be important. So, you know, if you are interested in listening to the Watchmen podcast and keeping up, I would definitely recommend looking it over, because the visuals are important in a graphic novel, surprisingly. Yeah.
Then in good ones, they tend to be tied really tightly into what is happening and, you know, the emotion of the scene and all that good stuff.
Yep.
Because, you know, it's a visual medium, unlike a podcast.
I'm going to wear a Rorschach mask next week. Talk like that.
Yeah, so if I sound creeped out, that's what's going on. So, I think we're done with this here,
Are we done with this podcast?
Oh, Governor, I think this podding cast isn't...
Podding cast.
I do believe it has reached its conclusion.
Well then, thanks for listening this week.
Yes, and we will definitely see you next time.
Cheerio!